Hi everyone, Pamela Larg here, your host of the Energy Transitions podcast. If you enjoy listening to our bi-weekly podcast, make sure to hit the subscribe button and take a moment to leave a rating or review wherever you're listening. This will help us spread the message and connect with our community. Thanks again for listening to the Energy Transitions podcast from Enlit and Friends. Building an entire solar supply chain is no small feat, but that is exactly what German-headquartered Qcells set out to do in the US with a $2.5 billion investment. From ingots to wafers and solar cell manufacturing, it's all under one roof and is proving to be a hive of innovation and efficiency. To tell us more about these market developments in the US, I'm joined by Danielle Merfeld, Chief Technology Officer at Qcells. Merfeld explains why the US is of such strategic importance for Qcells and why she thinks Europe has lost its first mover advantage in the solar sector to the US. We also discuss the future of solar and whether there is still potential for innovation and disruption in this mature market. I'm your host, Pamela Larg, and this episode of the Energy Transitions podcast is brought to you in partnership with World Energy Council in the lead up to the 2024 World Energy Congress taking place in Rotterdam from 22 to 25 April. Danielle, thank you so much for joining me. Just over a year ago, Qcells committed $2.5 billion to a US expansion plan. Tell us, how are you progressing with that plan?
So overall, we're progressing very well. This is a quite ambitious plan. So not only is it a lot of funding to spend, it's a lot of work to do. Last fall, we completed the first part of our expansion for this plan, and that was within our Dalton module factory. We expanded it to 5.1 gigawatts, which is 30,000 panels a day. So that was completed last fall, and it is up and running, and I was recently there. And it's so exciting and impressive to see this in the US. I haven't seen anything like this in the US before. I said newsworthy portion of that investment is still in construction with some parts completed. And that's nearby Dalton. Just both of these cities are just outside of Atlanta. It's in Cartersville, Georgia. And this is where we're going to be building the whole supply chain from the growing of the ingot to slicing them into wafers to making cells to making modules, which is that first facility that I mentioned is only modules, which is the most common facility that people think of when they think of a solar plant. But this is going to be the whole supply chain. And that is about 3.3 gigawatts at each stage. And we've got the module portion of that up and running. We announced it earlier this week. So that's going. And we'll have the ingot and wafer and cell manufacturing up and running within the year.
You make it sound really simple, but I cannot imagine what goes into developing a supply chain. Okay, so talk me through the steps. How do you do this? How do you go about building the solar supply chain?
Yeah, well, so first of all, I love that it sounds easy. My team might not be so happy that I made it sound so easy, but it is straightforward, I should say, but quite complex. So when people think about supply chain, most of the times, they think about a critical material or mineral that's required to make a certain magnet or maybe lithium as a portion of batteries. So when they think of supply chain management or building a supply chain, they think about accessing these critical components. In the solar supply chain, yes, we have raw materials like glass and silicon and plastics materials that go into our system. But at each stage of development, it's like a whole factory. So to make the polysilicon is a huge facility. To take that polysilicon and melt it into these ingots of single crystal silicon, that's another factory, essentially. And there's quite a lot of capital and complex technology and know-how that go into this. Then the ingot is sliced into wafers, paper thin, even actually thinner than paper, 140 microns is the average, using these diamond wire saws that are 40 microns in width. This is itself another factory. Then these wafers go into a cell manufacturing factory. It's the workhorse of the solar magic. It changes photons into electric carriers that then are taken out of the cell. But the last part, which is the most visible, is where these cells, dozens of them together, are put into a frame and glass or encapsulant of some sort is put on the front and back. that is the solar module, where they're strung together and they actually have a way to get the electricity out of this. So when we talk about building a solar supply chain, it's actually this entire orchestration of these complex pieces that are in and of themselves, factories and technology and materials. And I'll take one step back from that, because most of the solar industry is quite aware of these important steps. But I will challenge everyone to think that it's not enough to have all of those steps under control, or even under one roof, as we're doing, which, by the way, helps a lot of innovation when you have things under one roof to learn and complete the cycle. But we're also investing in partnerships and engagements with other suppliers. Like, for example, we get our polysilicon from REC Silicon, a company that we've invested in, and we've helped them restart their silicon factory up in Washington State, which has been shuttered for about 5 years. It's recently turned back on to give us some domestic polysilicon that's also powered 100% by hydro. So it's very clean. So these are the kind of things that even we're investing to help create the raw materials that will go into our products. One of our affiliate companies that's also in the Hanwha Group, called Hanwha Advanced Materials, they've built an encapsulant facility right across the street from our new factory. So they're going to supply us the backsheet and encapsulants. So there's a lot of moving parts here that we're trying to not just orchestrate the factories that will run, but also these suppliers that we will depend on.
Incredible how everything really is under one roof. And I think I'd like to just touch on something. You mentioned that to have everything, as you say, under one roof helps with innovation. Can you give me some more information about that? I'd like to understand how that works.
Certainly. Well, so I would say the core of any forward momentum and innovation is understanding the data that you're getting along the way. And it's no different in solar manufacturing. So what is the quality of the ingot that you've grown? How much perfect crystallinity do you have? What impurities or content of various components and elements are in there? And can you trace that when you go from the ingot to the wafer, to the cell, to the module, taking data along the way? As you're making the cell, you're taking electroluminescence images, you're taking electro readouts from the leads, you're taking all of this data. And while it might be too much for any human data crunching to extract, using a lot of novel data management, AI-based technology, we can start to connect the dots on things that are one or two levels deeper. What is the data telling us, essentially? And if you orchestrate that data management right, by having access to all the data and having geographical access, meaning under one roof, the data can flow and the feedback loop can be closed more easily. Now, what is creating a great or a good enough solar module, we might find out that we have a lever to impact that at the cell or at the module or at the ingot level that we didn't even know we had, because it was coming from a separate facility. We didn't have, it was a broken cycle of information flow. So now keeping it under one roof, so to say, gives us this ability to close the loop on the data, which besides all the optimization and increasing our throughput and our value, we can also become more innovative. What new things can we try? What does that look like downstream? You know, does it improve or does it give a net pro or con to our system? So it just gives us a lot more degrees of freedom to invent.
That makes perfect sense. And we will be touching on innovation a little bit later in our conversation. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you, how easy or difficult has it been to actually develop the supply chain within the US? And I'd like to touch on perhaps the policy and regulatory aspects, especially post-IRA.
Yes. So I would say it is a night and day outlook, depending on whether the IRA is in place or before it was. Because before the IRA was in place, essentially developing a supply chain is like starting a flywheel. There's very little momentum at first. You have to put a lot of energy into creating the change. Whereas the Inflation Reduction Act created some of this momentum for the community. So there was a lower barrier to investment. There was more assurance of an opportunity to have a longer payback cycle for these investments. So before that policy was in place, it would have been very difficult to build out a supply chain the way we are so comprehensively doing, because it wouldn't have just been our company taking the financial risk and the strategic opportunity, but it would have been all those other businesses that I mentioned who we will depend on to partner or to supply us with raw materials, or even our recycling at the end of the loop. Having a circular economy is important to us. So having someone be motivated and participate in this broader ecosystem with us, we couldn't have engineered all of this with the sheer force of our own intent. So policy being in place is what has enabled, I think, this development of a US supply chain in solar.
Obviously, you are US-based, but I'd like to understand, in terms of the European solar supply chain, many have suggested that because of policies such as the IRA, Europe has actually lost its first mover status, especially in terms of solar. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, so it's interesting because I learn a lot from my colleagues, because Qcells was founded in Germany. So we are inherently European, we're rooted in Europe. A lot of our history was based on the dominance of Europe in the early days of the PV industry really growing. It was sort of the cradle of the PV industry before there was so much more growth in Asia, especially in China. This is the commercialization of the early 2000s. The largest sales market, the largest manufacturers of PV in the world were all in Europe. So today, Europe is much more highly dependent on imports. And I think last year, less than 3% of the 56 gigawatts of installations in Europe came from European components. So when it comes to manufacturing, Europe has certainly lost its first mover advantage already. This is something where the tide can always be turned. One can say that the IRA was a wake-up call to some European policymakers. And last year, we saw Europe propose its own Net Zero Industry Act. It's got a very big ambition, similar to the Inflation Reduction Act. It's a bit more complicated or maybe more cloudy in terms of how that can be deployed. So it certainly, I don't think, has seen the same nature of response that the Inflation Reduction Act did in the US. But, you know, that investment framework, the conditions for success, I think can be clarified and can be solidified so that member states can achieve the targets that have been set by 2030 or 2050. But today, I would say there's just a lot more ambition and hope than there has been policy support in Europe.
Obviously, solar power is quite a mature renewable energy technology. So I'd like to find out, in your opinion, is there space left to disrupt the sector? And what would that disruption look like?
So it's interesting. Whenever I talk to people who are not active in the solar sector, it's easy for them to, and it's very typical for them to have an expectation that solar is quite mature as a technology. It has been in the market for a long time. It's been very visible and to some degree vocal about its continued cost reductions, almost a methodical approach to the industry change and the energy transformation in general. But I think those of us who are in the industry see it even more extreme. The advances in performance and reliability and cost, while they are expected in the industry because of this history of increasing efficiency, is about 0.5% a year on average from our Qcells data. So it's easy to expect that you'll just keep seeing this improvement. But these are huge changes. I mean, the learning cycle is still going. So we're investing in new technology. We're uncovering new process improvements. Just the scale of the industry is turning that flywheel of learning even faster. So the types of technology being installed today is in even the newest N-type semiconductor panel-based technology that's being launched today, it's 25% better efficiency and power output than even a few years ago. So imagine any other portion of our energy sector having 25% power improvement in a few years. It's unheard of. So the PV industry being so modular and so versatile, it can play in a lot of different areas. It's easy to overlook that it's still very much developing and improving, and there's a tremendous amount of opportunity left. Now, that's a very optimistic also, but a very specific view on the solar module or cell technology. I will say, again, opening the aperture a bit more, you know, solar being the cheapest form of energy on the planet, it's even more so now being combined with storage to have new value in the industries and the markets that it plays. So there's all these ancillary benefits that solar is just now starting to extract in this energy ecosystem. But if you think about the solar solution, the hardware, you know, the inverters, microinverters, storage systems, and then the software that you wrap around that panel, essentially in various applications, there's a whole nother layer of innovation to unlock. So how we use solar, where we apply solar, and how we take advantage of this really low cost of energy that's very versatile and modular and can be on a very small scale or can take up acres, that's where the innovation is truly going to happen. Similar to how having a cell phone was a very cool novelty because now I didn't have to be tied to my landline. I would never have thought then when they were new that I would also bank on it and I would connect with old friends and I could talk and see people. Those kind of new things we haven't even started scratching the surface of with what solar in the energy system can uncover for us.
You mentioned circular economy, and it would be interesting to understand How is Qcells actually incorporating that into their strategy and their strategic outlook?
Well, thinking about the explosion of solar in our infrastructure over the next several decades, you can't imagine the building and the consuming of the materials needed without understanding how you can take those back at the end of life and reuse them. Certainly, it will be sustainable from a use of our materials in the world, but it's also a cost play, sustainable cost-wise, to extract that material back into our supply chain rather than continuing to extract it from virgin sources. So when I talk about a circular economy, it's about being a sustainable offer of safe and good products, but it's also about being a sustainable company and being able to reduce our costs year over year and enable these new streams of input into our systems. That takes designing that from the start, thinking about the recycling of the panel while you're designing the panel. What are the component parts? Which materials are needed? How can it best be disassembled? Or how can the materials be best extracted? That's the future when you think about the scale of solar. You have to be thinking about the full life cycle of those products.
So I can clearly see that you enjoy what you do and you enjoy working with Qcells and their technology. What about Qcells is unique, would you say?
Qcells was founded in 1999. So in these days, that's one of the oldest solar companies still around. So they are one of the original innovators. And what I think makes them unique is they went from being the Goliath to the David in this battle around solar. So they were the first company to reach a gigawatt scale. And now, while we are the largest manufacturer in the Western Hemisphere, we're very small compared to our largest Chinese competitors, who are 10 times larger than us in terms of their volume and their capability. And even though we're quite smaller as compared to them, and we have avoided being constrained by only being able to access certain parts of our value chain through Chinese sources, which keeps us kind of limited from taking advantage of all the latest growth, we're actually still competitive and we're still pushing at the forefront of technology in several areas. Most notably, this last year, laser enhanced contact optimization was a big breakthrough that the world started to see as we deployed product. And now this is kind of taking over a lot of future designs. So these kind of ways that we can still be innovative, I think in part due to our really deep bench of experience in Europe as our R&D. And now we've expanded doing more R&D in Korea. And we're now taking on the US market and bringing in talented and engaged individuals working with, you know, we're working with research institutes and national labs all around Europe, Asia, and the US. So we have a good network. So it's not just the brilliance of the individuals that I am fortunate enough to work with in Qcells, but they're bringing in smart people from all around. And so I think that's what makes us unique, is we have enough ambition to try to be the world's best, enough humility to know where we want to partner and where to bring in new ideas from. But the fact that we're a part of Hanma Group gives us this long-term ambition and courage to do some pretty awesome things. So I think that's what makes us unique.
That is unique indeed. And I love how you refer to the equal amounts of ambition and humility. That is clearly a recipe for success. Moving on to something perhaps a little bit more personal, how do you see yourself within this ecosystem at Qcells? Do you see yourself as an innovator, a disruptor? What is your personal recipe that keeps you going?
I think every technology leader, as I am one, wants to think of themselves as an innovator. So definitely that's something that I will absolutely claim. But the question is, innovating in what area? So I'm not the technical expert in all of the areas where we do technical innovation. How I see myself and what I try to bring to my work every day is connecting the dots between the innovations at the cell or module level, with our power systems, at the construction of our solution level, and ultimately connecting in with what some, you know, depending on where you are, it could feel like a whole different language, a whole different foreign universe of activity in the software world. So this is the nexus of what changes the energy sector, is the technology from these various hardware, software, materials. How does it come together? There's no one that has that breadth of expertise. So where I try to innovate is, how do we connect those dots better? And ultimately that will disrupt. So thinking about how to use solar in new ways, what is the next breakthrough that happens when we cross the next threshold of cost? Those are things that we have to be thinking about in advance. So it's not just enough to have a new technology. How are we going to make sure that banks trust it, so they'll loan people money, so they can buy a lot of it? So thinking about, how do we find the other pieces that will enable our success? That's my job. And it also gives me a chance to touch base with all of these fantastic technically deep wells of experience in the company. And that's what definitely keeps me going.
So as a dot connector at Qcells, what or who influences you?
So I think there's been so many technical transformations in the world. There have been the transformation of solid state lighting, changing out all of our incandescent based bulbs. There's been changing our cellular networks and how do we communicate. What inspires me, and actually the people who inspire me, are the innovators who have created the foundations for those change. So Shuji Nakamura, who won the Nobel Prize for his invention of the blue LED. A lot of the early days in cellular were based on some very core technology built by actually over decades of investment and insights from various technologists. So it's the people that build the little pieces that are necessary to unlock the future. That's what inspires me, is thinking about how can this one project, this one innovation, help be one of the keys needed to unlock a future that changes the world completely. And I think any of us working in the energy transition space are looking to unlock this future, where not only do we improve the outlook for our environment, and sustainability is a core part of what drives so many of us, but this future should be not just cleaner, but safer, more just, more prosperous. I mean, who doesn't want to be a part of unlocking that? You know, that's something that so many of us are driven by in this space.
Indeed. And speaking of unlocking a sustainable future, you are going to be speaking at the World Energy Congress in Rotterdam, if I'm not mistaken. Tell us a little bit about what you'll be speaking about and your key message to those who will be there.
Yeah, so my key message is going to be centered around the fact that innovation in clean energy technology is going to be critical to cutting our emissions, while also developing low-cost, accessible, reliable energy to communities around the world. So it's a combination of, we need innovation to get there, but we've got to do it in a way that's sustainable and accessible. And innovation, as I've been talking about today, it means a lot of things to me. You know, it's about being competitive and with conventional power. It's about having it be built all around the world in different types of applications. And then, of course, being sustainably made. So part of a circular economy. The innovation opportunities abound here.
Do you have any final comments or thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, one of the things that I hope to get across when I'm at the World Energy Congress, when I'm talking more generally about the solar industry, is it can be thought of as a mature space. I've mentioned this already. But what I don't think people realize is we still need to grow as an industry, and we need a lot of talent, a very different broad nature of talent, to come and join us in this growth. I think there might be some people, especially young people, who presume that this is mapped out, that they are going to have to find a new thing to work on, like fusion or advanced geothermal, some of the hot new areas. And they might discount solar as being something that's already set or already full of talent. This is going to be broadening our horizons, and it's going to be increasing its impact in our energy economy for some time. And it's growing faster than any other energy technology on the planet. So my main message would be, please join us. There's a need for technologists, quality operators, developers, tool manufacturers, everything. Solar is a rich space for growth, and it needs the top talent in the world to help us really deliver on the first decade of the energy transition, which is rooted in solar.
Well said, and a great message to conclude. Danielle, thank you so much for your time. It has been an absolute pleasure.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Pam.
And thank you to our listeners. Until next time. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast, brought to you by Enlit and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Log, and our producer, Kamo Motse. We hope you can join us next time. Visit enlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.